Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Joel McGuire, registration number 9073, appearing on behalf of John Becker, the defendant. In my personal opinion, to the extent that it matters, what happened to Mr. Becker is pretty outrageous, and I'm here today to see if anything can be done about that. He signed the $300,000 note, there's no question about that. He did it to settle a personal injury claim against his wife and allegedly against him that was worth cost of defense at most about $10,000.
Well, let me stop you right there.
Yes.
So he did it to settle a personal injury claim. Is that your position?
That was one of the things. That was one of the reasons why he did it. The second reason was, and I think the primary reason, was to make sure his wife was not charged with a felony in a criminal action against her. And he also did it to obtain a deferred sentence for his wife, which of course she never received. And this was the same personal injury claim that Mr. Greshler had investigated for Ms. Rademacher 6 months earlier, where he hired a private investigator to go out and interview a neighbor who was a witness who observed Ms. Rademacher before and after this incident. And this was 6 months after Ms. Rademacher had determined, apparently based on that investigation, that she was not going to pursue any personal injury claim against anyone relating to this incident. And Ms. Rademacher testified that she and Mr. Becker never talked about the value of any of her claims. Now, obviously, even though the jury had some serious misgivings about awarding Ms. Rademacher money in this case, or certainly the amount that she was asking for, it concluded that it had to find in her favor based on the instructions it received. And so we didn't get the result we wanted at trial. So the question here is whether, despite the verdict, the evidence requires a different result, even when the evidence is reviewed in the light most favorable to Ms. Rademacher.
Did you have any objections to the instructions that were given at trial?
Not to the instructions at issue here, and the ones that are at issue, I suppose, not the fraud instruction. The one instruction, or actually there are two instructions, both of which included the element of lack of free will. And as I said in the opening brief, the jury came back with a question of what does free will mean, or lack of free will, something like that, and the judge consulted with the attorneys. I mean, I'm not claiming that he did this on his own. And he said, and it's in the record, whatever he said, it was basically, I'm going to tell the jury that they have to follow the instructions that they were provided. So the jury was told something to that effect, and was not provided with a definition of a lack of free will.
Was there a request that the judge do something other than simply refer the jury to the instructions?
No. I don't recall any today, and if there was, I would have mentioned it in the brief. And so at that point, we were going by the stock instruction, which does not provide a definition of lack of free will. It just includes that element, but it does not define what that means. And so I think the assumption was, well, this is an instruction that has been given over time. It's been decided that this is appropriate under these, for this defense, the duress defense, the undue influence defense, and therefore it's probably all that's needed. And obviously in hindsight, I certainly would have done something differently, but it wasn't done. There was no request at the time the jury came back with a question. So let's look at the evidence in the light most favorable in this line. She knew that Joanne could be charged with a felony because she received the DA's letter February 24, 2010. That set forth the plea offer that had been made to Joanne Becker. But she knew, Ms. Rademacher knew, that Joanna could avoid a felony if she accepted that plea offer. She had sent, Ms. Rademacher had sent an impact statement to the DA, asking that Joanne be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But Ms. Rademacher knew, at least believed, that she had no say in the plea negotiations, no control over the plea negotiations. And according to Ms. Rademacher, Mr. Becker knew that Ms. Rademacher had sent some letter to the DA, and that letter was bad for Joanne. And the evidence, again, this is in the light most favorable to Ms. Rademacher, and most of this is undisputed. Neither Joanne nor her defense attorney ever talked to Mr. Becker about the criminal case. And David Harrison, the defense attorney in Boulder, testified to that effect, that he never talked to Joanne. And Joanne said the same thing. She never talked to Mr. Becker because Mr. Becker was still involved with Ms. Rademacher at the time. And Mr. Harrison instructed her not to talk to her husband, from whom she was separated at the time, about the criminal case. So prior to Mr. Becker reading Ms. Rademacher's letter, the first paragraph of which sets forth the plea offer, he was unaware that the DA had made a plea offer to Joanne that would allow her to avoid a felony by simply pleading guilty to the misdemeanor. Now, it's also understood that Mr. Becker was very concerned about the existence or the possibility of a felony charge against his
wife. If I may interrupt you, counsel, I think we're very familiar with the facts.
Okay.
So I have a legal question to ask you. You have cited some cases regarding illegality of contracts. They're all almost 100 years old. Do you have any newer authority?
No, I've looked and I haven't found any. I think one was 1930, Texas.
31.
And then there's another one that's much more recent. It's more like 1975 or 85 or something like that. And I think that's the Germantown case, if I recall. But I guess that I don't find that particularly surprising, given the unique nature of the facts of this case and. I don't think that this situation arises very often, where you have, and the points in those cases are, a party should not be able to obtain a civil settlement through use of the criminal justice system. The opportunity to do that, I think, is fairly limited, and I imagine that these types of cases don't arise very often, so that doesn't particularly surprise me.
What should this court do with the evidence that your client was a participant in seeking this settlement, and in fact part of it was to settle a civil claim? What do we do with those pieces of it?
Well, the way this arose, according to Ms. Rademacher, is that after she submitted her impact statement, that's when the negotiations started, because although she had received some letters from her insurance company about her medical bills, which were, she received all of her medical bills to restitution, and those totaled about $11,000 or $12,000. Although she received some letters, the real start of the negotiations occurred after she submitted her impact statement, and after it became apparent to Mr. Becker that there was a possibility that his wife could be charged with a felony. Now, certainly, he was interested in trying to resolve all of this stuff, because he did say that he felt that this never would have happened but for him, his relationship with Ms. Rademacher. So he was trying to settle everything. But that doesn't mean he has to be saddled with a settlement that's 30 times what would be a reasonable settlement of Ms. Rademacher's claims.
So is it your position that the entire settlement agreement is void simply because part of it had to do with a criminal matter?
Yes, it is, because it was an extremely important part. But for the threat of a felony charge, which Ms. Rademacher was aware was not really a threat, because she knew Joanne could accept the plea offer that was on the table, She could accept that before or at the case management conference, which was 10 days after this conference in Mr. Gressler's office, that threat would go away. She could accept that. There was no need for her letter, but she used that threat in order to obtain this settlement.
Okay, let's go beyond your case for a moment, because if we rule in your favor, this would be a brand new rule of law in Colorado. Do you agree with that?
I don't believe so, but...
Do you have any authority to indicate that that's ever been the ruling before?
The ruling, I guess I'm not clear on what particular ruling you're referring to.
If you, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, my understanding is that you're asking us to reverse the decision of the trial court and vacate the case on the grounds that this was an illegal contract.
Well,
have I misunderstood your argument?
I think I did. I may have said illegality at some point, either in the trial court.
Well, then what is your position? Why do you think you get some relief here?
Because I think the evidence in the light most, under the rules, the judge, the trial court, can reverse the jury's verdict if the evidence, if no reasonable juror could reach that conclusion. And what I'm saying is the evidence, even in the light most favorable to her, shows fraud, shows duress, shows undue influence, and further, the court, sua sponte, and that includes this court, can decide that the undisputed, in my mind, undisputed use of the criminal justice system to obtain this settlement, which was 30 times the amount of a reasonable settlement, is against public policy, that the courts of this state should not allow that result.
So Mr. McGuire, what is the specific source of public policy that you're relying on in this state?
It's the sites that I gave to the other cases in the other states. There's references in this state to public policy violations. I think
but typically when this court finds a public policy violation, it points to a source of public policy and generally a legislative action of some type to guide it.
Well, I guess I haven't attempted to define that. The cases in the other states that I quoted just refer to public policy in general, that they're not going to give their judicial stamp of approval to this practice. And so I guess they felt, I mean, there was no cite to a legislation in those cases. And I guess it was more like a gut feel, so to speak, that the court was saying, look, this is outrageous. This should not happen. We're not going to allow it. And it's against public policy. So, what I'm asking, Your Honor, is that because of the evidence in this case, based on the evidence, the jury should have come back, or I shouldn't say the jury should, because they didn't, as they felt they were instructed. But the result requires a finding for Mr. Becker on his defenses, and also, as I stated...
So you're asking us to reweigh the evidence and be a 13th juror. Is that what you're asking?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because I'm...
So you're asking us to find as a matter of law that the evidence was insufficient?
Well, not that the evidence...
I think your only winning argument, potentially, is public policy. So help us
okay.
See why we should rule in your favor.
I'm not asking that you reweigh the evidence. I believe I've set forth the evidence that I'm arguing on in the light most favorable to Ms. Rodnacher. Therefore, it's not reweighing the evidence. And it's not asking that the evidence be found to be insufficient. It's saying that the defenses were established as a matter of law based on the evidence in the light most favorable to Ms. Rodnacher. That plus the public policy aspect of this. And what I'm asking for is a remand and a direction that judgment enter in favor of Mr. Becker. And I would say, although I'm not sure anybody would really want this, but there is the right or the ability to remand for a new trial under Rule 59G. because it says that the trial court, when faced with that motion, that would be one option. So you could send it back and say, okay, instruct the jury in this matter, and let's have another go at it. And I am done. Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Ida Rushler from 376, appearing on behalf of Carol Adler. To extend the personal feelings have anything to do with this, I have a personal feeling too, which is that I would not personally be a party to what Mr. McGuire says he's so outraged about. But in any event, it seems to me that the appeal here is based, at least factually, on two issues. First of all, this claim that my clients, that the settlement of $300,000 was outrageously high. And second, that my client somehow used the criminal justice system to induce a settlement in this case. So I know you're familiar with the facts of this case, but it seems like we're arguing about the facts here, so forgive me. This incident occurred on August 7th of 2009. There was a dispute, an assault between Carol Rademacher and Joanne Becker. And I do ask the court's forgiveness. My client was aware before she came to the home of Mr. Becker on August 7th of the emails that Ms. Becker had discovered the night before. That was an error in my brief, and I apologize for that. There's no dispute that my client was asked by Mr. Becker to bring him breakfast. There's a dispute about whether or not my client was asked to come in by Mrs. Becker. And at one time, Mr. Becker says that told Ms. Becker's defense counsel that that's what did happen.
Pardon the interruption, counsel. Please. I'm having trouble seeing how the facts that you're reciting at the moment are going to relate to any ruling that we might make.
Okay. Well, I guess what I would say is this. There was liability. Okay, there was liability for Mrs. Becker, for her assault, for her outrageous conduct. There was liability for Mr. Becker potentially under because he was a property owner, he failed to protect. There's been several cases decided in that area in terms of the duty of a property owner to defend against the probable actions of third parties. Warren v. Best Buy Stores, LP 303 P3rd 558, the 2003 case, the most 2013 case, the most recent of several cases in that area. On the issue of the amount of liability, I think this may help you. If you look at the procedure involved in this case, there was a dispute between the parties about whether or not this was about a personal injury case my client could have brought, or whether this was about my client's no case that she did in fact bring. And so it would be disputed about whether or not my client's medical records were even at issue in this case. And so the trial was set for November 13th, I'm thinking on top of my head, like I have it on my notes somewhere, I'm not seeing it. November 18th, I'm sorry. So on September 5th, 2013, the defense files a motion to require plaintiff to disclose whether she intends to testify as to medical condition, and if so, condition testimony on disclosure of medical records. This motion was opposed, my opposition was denied, and on October 22nd, 2013, the magistrate ruled that we had until November 8th to produce all medical records. And this is medical records for my client's claim of having a colon bruise, having a retinal bleed, having a neck situation, aggravating.
Mr. Gresham, yes. I'm sorry, I need to redirect you.
Please.
As well. Because I think what you're saying is not assisting us.
Okay.
So I want to guide you in
Tell
a way
me what I can do.
That I'm hoping will. Do you agree that at some point the decision, the letter written by your client to the Boulder District Court was connected to the settlement agreement in this case?
The letter that was written was a letter that was requested by Mr. Becker at the settlement conference.
And do you agree, therefore, that it was connected to the settlement agreement?
Mr. Becker required it, therefore it was.
Okay. So there's really a public policy issue, it strikes me, that we're dealing with, and not a factual dispute as to what happened below. And the public policy issue is this court in a position to condone the practice of combining civil settlement agreements with criminal penalties? And it seems to me that that's the position that we're in based on the connection that you just acknowledged exists in this case.
Your Honor, it seems to me that, well, first of all, let me say that there was no question that Mr. Becker was clear, I think based on the evidence at trial, that Mr. Becker was clear that his wife was not charged with a felony and did not have to be charged with a felony and had the ability to plead guilty to a misdemeanor. Okay, the only thing that that letter was addressing was my client's position as to whether or not his client might be considered for a deferred sentence. That's, I mean, now you can say that's still public. I understand that. And Your Honor, what I can say is that I think my client had the right to take, I mean, I do say something like this in my brief, okay? I think my client had the right to change her impact statement. I think that when my client is, you know, when an arrangement is made for my client to be compensated, that can affect her position on how the DA should take to approach the case. I think that Mr. Becker has acknowledged, although his testimony is very varied, that he acknowledged at certain points in his testimony that he understood that that's what that letter meant, that my client didn't have control over what the DA said, but that her voice might be heard and it might affect the type of plea bargain that his wife might receive. And so I don't think that my client did anything improper by changing her request to the district attorney.
But can I jump in for a moment?
Please.
Here? Isn't the issue that even if there was no malintent on the part of either of the parties, and each of them may have been doing it for what they thought were well-founded, legitimate reasons, that doesn't address the public policy issue with respect to what the public's interest may be in allowing the criminal aspect of the case to get wrapped up into the civil settlement?
Well, let me just say this. I think that, and once again, this is as I addressed in the brief, and from a public policy point of view, and I realize that, you know, we're talking in terms of sort of like a categorical comparative here, right? It's not, well, what if the rule in this case were recognized for everyone, right? That's your concern. I understand that, right? So if a criminal defendant, let's not talk about this case, let's talk about it in the abstract, okay? If a criminal defendant goes to a victim, okay, and says, look, I'm making restitution to you. I know the court hasn't ordered me to, I'm not required to, but I have a consciousness of guilt, I did something wrong, I'm making restitution to you. Okay, and I'd like you, if you agree with me that this restitution is adequate, I would like you to change what you're asking the DA to do in this case, right? If that is, and I think that's the situation here, right? I mean, that's the way I would frame the situation.
And I think the latter part of what you said is where the problem comes
right.
in. I think there's a right to a voluntarily attempt to make restitution.
Right.
But then when you condition making the restitution on requiring the other party to take some action to impact the criminal case, I think that may be where it creeps over into some problems.
So you don't think that that a criminal defendant should be able to, excuse me, a criminal victim, should be able to enter into that kind of an agreement? In other words, if you make restitution to me, and I'm okay with that, knowing that the court may order restitution anyway, you know?
Well, and I think you can go into court and you could say, look, Judge, be easy on me, or you can tell the prosecutor, be easy on me. I stepped up, I took responsibility, I made restitution.
Yes.
But if you condition the making of the restitution on the victim taking some specific action, that to me is where it may cross the line.
Well, you know, I have to disagree with you. I think if there's an acknowledgement by everybody that this is not binding on the prosecution, which it's certainly not, I think, and I think that if the of course, you know, the legal system is not compromised by this. Okay.
Why isn't it? Why isn't that against public policy to have people change their position in a criminal prosecution? Is there's a reason why they call it people versus so and so. It's not, you know, the victim versus so and so in the criminal prosecution.
And the reason is because it is the people versus. Okay, it's not the victim versus. Okay, the victim can say, oh, you know, I mean, you see this in cases all the time. The victim says, oh, you know, my husband didn't really mean to hit me.
Domestic violence case,
yeah.
Okay, that the perpetrator pays the victim to not testify against him.
That's different. That's a different case, because then the system is being corrupted. Okay, then the judge, the trial doesn't get the evidence. This is not that. Okay, this is just the suggestion that the victim has about what the penalty should be. If you're paying somebody to not testify, I have a very big problem with that, and you should too.
So there's a statute.
Okay, so
query what the statute applies to the situation that happened here.
Well,
how do you differentiate then your circumstance from the public policy issues as set forth in the ACOC case?
Which one?
That's
is that?
It's a North Carolina case. Are you familiar with it? You may not.
I guess I'm not.
Okay. All right. It seems to say an agreement to stifle a prosecution of any kind is void and unenforceable, and that had to do with somebody trying to influence the fact that their nephew had been arrested.
And so once again, this is not stifling a prosecution. Okay, this is not stifling a prosecution.
But it's attempting to influence it. As conditioned upon the civil settlement.
Well, you know, once again, my client does not saying that she won't cooperate with the prosecution. My client is not changing her testimony in this prosecution. My client is only saying, instead of go to the maximum, just consider a lighter plea bargain, and I know, and you know, and we all know that you're going to do whatever you want. Okay, and I have no control over that. This is just my input. Okay, I think that is fundamentally different than saying I'm not going to testify, or I don't support this prosecution, or this guy didn't do it. I think that is a bright line.
Mr. Kressler, yes. Do you have any authority that support the argument that you're now making that this is different, that it's a distinction, that it's on the other side of the bright line from these public policy concerns that we've been raising to you?
No, I mean it hasn't been addressed to me in this way before, so I don't have that authority. But I do think that this conduct that we're talking about here is defined by the statute that was cited.
Okay.
And I would take the position that this conduct is not subject, in response to Judge Terry's query, this conduct is not offensive. Well, thank you for directing me in the area of your interest, and thank you for listening to me this morning.
Thank you. And I don't believe, Council, Mr. McGuire, you had any further time. All right, well, thank you for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course. The court will be in recess.